32. He is describing Eloise as she was years earlier. Go on, please. She found her place. Her wit and her beauty would have fired the dullest and most insensible heart, and her education was equally admirable. Wow, Kavanaugh said. Rachel laughed abruptly. Gee whiz, she said, and he realized that once again she was teasing him. As if in apology, she said, I told you before how sometimes you make me think of the men in movies, Jimmy Stewart. Kavanaugh rocked his chair back good-naturedly, cowboy-wise, but he jolted the table, the coffee. He said, My goodness, but self-mockingly. Then he added, Jimmy Stewart meets Simone Weil. They, she said. What? We did this yesterday, she said, not Weil, but they. Okay, he grinned. I stand corrected, but with your turban, if I may say, you don't resemble the famous, he hesitated on the words Jewish and French, and said neither. Martyr. Rachel touched the black fabric at her ear. There is a story about this head covering in France. What story? He asked. It became the fashion after the war. That's it? He asked. The story? Yes. You were in France? But of course. He said, a young creature in Paris, like Eloise? Rachel Vedette nodded. My world and hers, so separated by time, coincided in space, yes, Paris. They say she was about 20 when she and Abelard were together at Notre Dame. When I was 20, I used to walk past Notre Dame every day, twice every day, back and forth, from Ile Saint-Louis to the Musée de Cluny on the left bank. He said, You refer to Cluny in your docent speech. Yes. The great abbey was in Bourgogne, of course. Nothing there but ruins today. But the abbot had a palace in Paris, his, what do you say, townhouse. It is well preserved, now a museum of the Middle Ages. Like the cloisters? He asked. She smiled. Well, the musée is not a pastiche. But in feeling, yes, like the cloisters, which I admit is what drew me here. I was hired, first, as a cleaner. He said, Then they realized how much you know. She smiled again, but vaguely. She rolled the tip of her cigarette in its ashes and added, Although in the Paris Museum there is also the archive and the scholarly center, the Institut Médiéval. She took a drag then, a hefty one. Smoke came out of her nostrils as if she were a man. She said, After the Revolution, 1789, no? I've heard of it, he said. I'm sorry, she said. The ladies in my tours think Revolution, 1776. So, after the Revolution, the monasteries were destroyed. You know this, too. But the monastic libraries were also looted. The greatest medieval libraries in Europe, Cluny, but also Clairvaux, Clermont, Morimond, Bec. Terrible destruction, the coming of laïcité, you say, secularism. It was the hatred of everything Catholic, including books, including also the Roman writers and the Greeks. What was not destroyed was hidden. Thousands of codices, scrolls, and single leaves, many magnificently illuminated, were left on unmarked shelves across the country, slowly decomposing for 100 years. Only in the 20th century did scholars rescue the lost works that were suddenly deemed the patrimony of France. The Institut Médiéval became the main repository of the salvaged texts. One of those putting the fragments together was my father. I was his assistant.
Really?
Yes. Working on what?
Abelard.
But what? She asked.
I thought you were Jewish.
She nodded.
My father began as a scholar of Talmud, Kabbalah, medieval Jewish texts,
tales of the Midrash. He retold them. The monasteries had collected all that, too. Professor Saul Vedet was famous as an expert on Moses Nachmanides.
Maimonides? He asked.
Nachmanides, she said. Someone else.
Oh,
I'm sorry,
No matter.
But then, of course, everything changed in France, little more than a decade ago. With the darkness, my father moved to the study of Abelard, who was his light. He was researching why such a figure was condemned by the church.
I don't know much, he said, but I know Abelard was condemned because of Eloise.
Kavanaugh gestured toward Rachel's book. Maybe not hedonism, as you say, but as her lover, no? Wasn't that her offense?
Oh, Father, forgive me, but that is a terrible distortion.
Why then? He asked.
She laughed. Well, for the much better reason that he was a heretic.
A heretic? For what?
For what, among other things, he believed about Jews.
Rachel Vedet pierced him with her dark eyes. Kavanaugh recalled the image occurring to him earlier, that in this woman's presence he'd been dragged into another room. But now he thought, not a room, but a ledge from which one could fall. It was a feeling he'd had before.
When?
With Runner. That's when. He saw it when she registered that he had no reply to make. She went on. Saint Bernard saw to Abelard's being condemned, and he ordered his writings burned, which is why you have not studied them, why apart from these letters, she indicated the book, you have not heard of Abelard's work.
But Jews? He asked finally.
Abelard was charged with multiple errors, one of which was his suggestion that Jews were not condemned by God for murdering Christ. Therefore, so my father argued, Jews remain beloved of God.
I hold that, he said. I'm not a heretic.
You believe Jews are saved? Outside the church?
If they act in good conscience, yes.
Outside Jesus? Jews have no need of Jesus?
Well, the words of Jesus from the Gospel of John popped open in Kavanaugh's mind. No man comes to the Father but by me.
But he pushed those words away to say, during the war, I closed the eyelids of dozens of boys. It never occurred to me that God's love for them depended on their being baptized.
She said, my father found that to be Abelard's position, exactly.
Abelard was condemned for it.
Kavanaugh could not think what to say.
She said, Abelard believed and taught that every person is saved by virtue of being created by the Creator. God is available in the human capacity for thought. That's all. No church, no Jesus, just creation, reason. For that, they burned his writings. My father was trying to retrieve them from manuscripts that were hidden in medieval monasteries, then lost.
But your father was a Talmud scholar?
Until 1940, yes.
But, he asked,
1940?
You know of the Statut des Juifs, the Jewish law?
My father was creating an argument against those laws, against Vichy, not an argument precisely, a récit, a story.
Its hero, Abelard, the great French Catholic, was to be my father's witness, a witness for the Jews. That was my father's great idea. But naturally, the witness was never called. She lifted the book. I, nevertheless, ever since, have kept faith with Abelard and with Eloise. As witnesses, he asked, or what? She shrugged. I cannot let them go. What was your phrase yesterday? Death grip. He shook his head. I was thinking of the Irish, he said, how we nurse the hurts of the past. Hurts need nursing, perhaps, she said. Until the hurt is gone, he said. And when is that, father? She fell silent. Kavanaugh sat in silence, too. Finally, he asked quietly, What is the hurt? She lifted her shoulders. That my father's great idea was foolish. He should not have been encouraged in it. Her shoulders fell. Who encouraged him? Rachel brought her eyes to the priest's. I did. You say that as if you are admitting to something. She shrugged again. Why foolish? Kavanaugh asked. Because it was dangerous. I don't understand, he said. Dangerous, she said sharply, for a Jew. Kavanaugh could not think what to say. The silence fell once more. At last he asked, You were 20? As the climax came, yes. That's young. And a long time ago, she said. Walking past Notre Dame every day, he said. Rachel was relieved to laugh. You pronounce it like the American football team, she said. Kavanaugh blushed the rube again. Yeah, well. Veering away from both his embarrassment and the pit of her anguish, she said, Coming from home on Île Saint-Louis, I approached the cathedral from the rear where there was an expanse of grass. I always stared up at the Arc Bouton, you say, buttresses. Flying buttresses, he said. Yes, because I did not want to look at the men who were at rest, lounging on the grass in that park beside the cathedral. They were German soldiers. We Parisians called them haricots verts because of their gray-green uniforms. Realizing that Kavanaugh had missed the meaning, she said, Green beans. Then she added, But when I passed, they were half-naked sunbathers, happy to be seen as decadent. They displayed themselves. I hated knowing that they were looking at me. She stubbed out her cigarette in the ashtray forcefully. But this is all too much about me. No, it's not, he said. She said, You began to explain. Thrown for a loop, you said. A stranger at the mass yesterday, the bishop this morning. Not a stranger. Who then? This fellow from the seminary in Yonkers when I was young. But it's embarrassing, really, trivial, compared to what you were dealing with at that age. Still, she said, something is at stake, no? His nickname was Runner, because he was a track star. I was very close to him all those years ago. He disappeared. And then again yesterday he disappeared. Suddenly it mattered to me to find out why. I went downtown today and asked the bishop. He knows, but he wouldn't tell me. Kavanaugh shrugged. That's all. It's nothing. She said, But to you the unknown answer carries weight nonetheless. I guess so. So you should find it. You should go to this man, Runner, and ask him. But that's the point. I have no way to find him. That is not true, Father.
He came to you yesterday. He wants to be found. You can find him.
Kavanaugh stared at her, marveling at the simplicity of her statement. He almost asked, "And how would I do that?" As if in reply, she said, "The bishop knows?"
"Yes. It surprised me how unsettled I was when I realized he was keeping something from me, and had been all along. I am surprised at how shocked I was to recognize some kind of deception from the bishop. He is a friend, but more than that, he is the church itself to me, and he has deceived me. That is what I saw. A vocation that stakes everything on the absolute? Is that what you said before?
Abelard and Eloise, perhaps. But not me. In my case, I am realizing the vocation is staked not on the absolute, but on something very shaky.
All the more then, Father, you must have your questions answered.
You don't understand, miss. There's this thing called the seal, secrecy. The bishop is bound by it.
But you are not, she said. She eyed him steadily. There is a way to learn what you need to learn. You must find it.
That she said this with such certainty made him realize that she had been through so much more than he had. She was a veteran of grim accomplishment. Kavanaugh found it possible to hold her gaze, but as he did, his mind went elsewhere. All at once, he was back in Bishop Donovan's outer office, with his eyes casting about the room. The receptionist, bent over her ledger, was resolutely ignoring him. What he saw now was the file cabinet behind her, the top drawer, a label that he had not consciously registered, but which he now saw as reading, "Current Correspondence." He recalled Bishop Donovan's words, "A letter from him, special delivery, out of the blue."
"Yes," Kavanaugh said, "I see what you mean." But he said it with finality, shutting the lid on the subject of his own uneasiness. Rachel Vedette placed her hand on the leather-bound book of letters. She gave it the slightest nudge, bringing it together with his breviary, so that the two edges of leather touched.
"Will you take this," she asked, "my book, read what's written here, to discuss it with me?"
"I've just told you," he said. "I know little or nothing of the absolute.
This was my father's book. I have not parted with it since." In the silence, even Kavanaugh knew better than to require her to finish the sentence.
"Yes," he said, "I will be careful with it." He picked up her book and also his own. Her request meant he would see her again.
Chapter 11. The deck cabin to which Eloise had repaired to be out of the sun was one of two ad hoc structures standing at either end of the long, narrow river vessel. Since they were running with the current downstream toward the river's mouth at the sea, only one sail had been deployed. For nearly 4 days the wind had been fair, the boat's progress smooth. Now, as the sailing barge approached the voyage's end, Eloise heard the pair of pole men who stood ready fore and aft, calling out numbers, alerting the barge master to the depth of the water. Soon enough, she felt the jolt when the boat ran aground. She lifted the tarp clear of her cabin opening to look out. It was late afternoon, and though the sunlight had lost its edge, still she found it necessary to shield her eyes, blinking in the brightness. The cutwater of the boat was at rest in the shallow elbow of shoreline, between a watermill and a muddy beach from which the ground sloped gently up to a quayside thoroughfare. Along it, stone buildings and houses were organized around a stout Merovingian basilica. So this was Nantes. One crewman was dropping the sail, and another was looping the line around a stump on the shore. The party's second barge banged into them from behind, and the third approached. That last and largest barge was given over to the war dogs who had offered protection from night bandits at their campsites, and the supplemental oarsmen and dray horses that would be needed when the barges made the return voyage upstream. But the second boat, just kissing hers, was Peter's. She turned to see him. From his place in the prow, Peter waved at her. Across the distance that separated them, his beaming smile spoke eloquently of their happiness. For Eloise, the days since their departure from Paris had been dreamlike, especially once away from the city, they could drop the pretense that they were not traveling in the same party. At a tributary of the Loire, below Chartres, they had bidden farewell to the wagons and armed escort her uncle had insisted on providing to that point, for what he took, with his leap from her half-truth, to be her journey to Bourgogne. From there, they had launched themselves on the soothing rhythms of flowing water. When their three-boat flotilla had come to the main river's northern bend at Orléans, they had followed the flow to the west instead of heading east toward the ducal palace in Dijon. The bargemaster alone understood that their course was not what had been implied. Peter had smothered an outright deception with ambiguity, but he had also seen that the boatman's discretion was well rewarded. Though Peter and Eloise had not found it possible to be alone in a trinity of small vessels carrying gossip-prone servants and crew, the simple fact of their escape from the confines of the Paris cloister had been enough. As darkness fell at the end of each day, the barges had tied up on the shore, and in the servant bustle of encampment, the hour or so of boats being secured, dogs deployed, horses fed, fires stoked, shelters erected, and bedding laid, they had come together casually on the crossbeam of her vessel, pretending to share nothing more than a taste for the clean air and the golden flare of sunset. But for them, the air was freedom itself, and the fading light glowing across open bogs or filtered through towering woodlands offered a glimpse of heaven. For the first time in their lustful history, Eloise sensed something wholly new in Peter, his capacity for calm affection. Until she felt herself the object of his quiet devotion, she had not known how, in addition to the ecstasies of Eros, she had been longing for this chaste counsel of contented intimacy, too. Oddly, it was here on the untamed river that she felt her wild, uneven life coming finally into balance, and she wished that everything and everyone except herself and Peter, as they were at these moments, would utterly disappear. Nothing on earth but the two of them, no past or future, only now. Surreptitiously at such instants, with one hand resting on her abdomen, where their child nested, she had reached with the other to take Peter's hand. When, in the magic of twilight, she felt his hand pressing hers in turn, a secret fever coursed through their fingers, heat beyond, if possible, what she'd felt in their frenzied, naked coupling in the dangerous shadows of Paris. Now they were arrived, and Eloise turned from looking at Peter to take in the sight of the prosperous river town with its mill, grain house, animal pens, boatyard, stone dwellings, and substantial church. To her surprise, in this first glimpse of Nantes, the future seemed to show itself. She sensed that here events would form the hinge between the lost if blustery girl she'd been until now, and the unperturbed woman she would be once she had a healthy son and his faithful father settled, however their bond of love took shape in the world as it was. Lucille was waiting for them on the rough ledge of the river bank, where trodden grass held back the tidal mud. She was a pasty woman, looking from the heft of her to be well into her fourth decade. Her hair was hidden in the veil that creased her forehead. Her face, even shadowed, was bright with welcome. Hers was a familiar visage, since, as Eloise saw at once, Lucille had Peter's sharp nose and his sweetly cleft chin. To her tawny skirts clung a diminutive, smock-clad child, while a pair of boys wrestled roughly at her feet. Beside her stood an even larger man, in whose arms squirmed an even younger child. Because the sun was low in the sky behind them, the man and woman, together with their children, were suspended in a radiant aura, making them seem a chosen family, or such was the fuzzy thought that came unbidden to Eloise. Enough of that, she focused. The man wore the sleeveless leather jerkin of an armorer, with a belt buckled at his ample belly by an oval of silver. A riot of long red hair and a rich red beard were organized around a broad smile, which made him seem the jolly fellow Peter had promised he would be. Marcus, then. Eloise was surprised to realize that she had, perhaps in a dream, anticipated such an arrival, imagining some while ago a world of contentment, even in exile. This unlikely expectation seemed fulfilled when Lucille, seeing them and scooping up her child, rushed forward happily. Peter, she cried, dear Peter, praise God you are here. As Peter scrambled across the mud to his sister, Eloise took special notice of the deftness with which Lucille handled her child as she took her brother into her embrace. The woman's heart was large and her manner competent. Marcus, a skilled metal crafter and purveyor of breastplates and ringmail to the constables of the Duke of Bretagne, was a prosperous man. The house he provided for his family was large and well-built, a three-story stone and timber structure with decorated mullioned windows before which candles were set and soon lit. Eloise enjoyed watching the children rattle around the place. Given that guests were present, they seemed unusually free-spirited. After a raucous meal, and once the children were asleep, Lucille and Marcus sat formally with Eloise and Abelard in the central ground-floor hall before the warming hearth, the hosts in high-backed wooden chairs, the visitors on stools. Peter made his explanations with a curl of feeling for which Eloise loved him. When he'd finished, Lucille stood, crossed to Eloise, took her hands into her own, and said, "Daughter, you are at home with us." And so she was. Peter, comforted by the peace Eloise had found in the embrace of his family, returned within weeks to Paris. But he was anxious, too, about what awaited him on the overheated island in the Seine. From his later recounting, Eloise knew what he had found at the cloister of Notre Dame. His wholly self-absorbed students had resented his unexplained absence from the dais, and more than 300 rowdies had shown up for the first of his resumed lectures, which was teasingly announced on posters throughout the school with the one-word title, Ergo. The implication of Master Peter's jibe was plain enough. "As you were about to conclude brilliantly before my absence so rudely interrupted you." When Peter mounted the platform, the students stomped, pounded, hectored and whistled, demanding his apologetic explanation. Peter put them off with joviality that was as counterfeit as it was, in the end, rhetorically triumphant. With a single upraised arm, palm open, he waited for them to fall silent. Laying his trap, he asked meekly, "Does the truant master owe his scholars an explanation?" They exploded again with whistles and stomping, demanding it. Again, seeking silence, he waited them out. Then, suddenly stern, he demanded, "Did Socrates explain himself to Plato?" he asked. "Or Plato to Dion?" He struck a tone that, once recognized as a challenge, ignited a happy sequence of alternating and competing antiphons. "Or Dion to Creon?" one called. "Or Heraclitus to Cratylus?" cried another, setting them off. "Or Aristotle to Timaeus?" "Or Cicero to Atticus?" And so on, until, as such raucous exchanges always did, the thing came round to Master Peter Abelard again. The boys were not disappointed when he cauterized their passionate rudeness with, "And did Zechariah owe an accounting to his ass?" The hoots at that could be heard across the river. The master was back. Over subsequent days, Peter Abelard learned that rumors had achieved the status of Holy Writ. His students had assured one another that his absence had been prompted by a summons from the abbot primate of Cluny, the monk potentate, seeking private forum counsel from the greatest teacher in Christendom. No, not Father Abbot, but the Cardinal of Sens. No, the school at Reims had hired him as rector. No, the great chapter at Chartres had finally issued its indictment, and Master Peter Abelard, in solemn disputation, had won the day at last against the white monk Bernard of Clairvaux, champion of a whole company of critics. Among the cathedral's other masters of philosophy, Abelard's intimate enemies, whisperers agreed that he was off with Jews, that his insults to the great Anselm and Rosalinus had reached the king's ears, that he would therefore be expelled from the school, that, intimidated by the coming great chapter and the threat of Bernard, he had fled Paris to avoid the subpoena which the cardinal was certain to have authorized by now. The clucking of fishmongers was nothing to the noise his rivals made. To Peter Abelard, however, there was only one figure whose current impression of him mattered, and that was Canon Fulbert. Peter was distressed to have learned that, as he feared, there had been one rumor that, although not rising to the credible level of others, had been discreetly passed among the inner circle of his admiring students, who, understanding its mortal danger, had apparently protected him by not spreading it more broadly. The tonsured Abelard was in violation of the vow of chastity with that fairest of girls oft seen in the cloister. Had Canon Fulbert heard those whispers? What did he suspect? Indeed, what did he know? On the Sunday after returning from Nantes, at solemn vespers, Peter Abelard and Fulbert would be together in choir with their fellow canons of Notre Dame, and Peter resolved to approach him. There were 24 canons regular, the senior clerics who served the cathedral as sacramental ministers, officers of the diocese, chaplains to the bishop, or, as in Abelard's case, masters of the school. In the absence of the bishop, Canon Fulbert presided at the festal ceremonies, and that was the case on this Sunday, as the evening celebration of the divine mystery unfolded. Into the dark reaches of the great vaulted nave soared the lilting chant of the Holy Office Psalter, together with pungent clouds of smoky incense. At the high altar, the Blessed Sacrament was lifted up in its crystal disk inside the hammered gold of the
sunburst monstrance, which shimmered in the light of a score of candles and oil lamps. Once the adoration was accomplished, with the singing of Panis Angelicus, the liturgical party, in addition to the canons, there were deacon acolytes, thurifers, and untonsured members of the minor orders, all robed variously, formed a long procession that wound behind torch candlesticks from the sanctuary, down the center aisle, through the crossing, to the sacristy lodged in the north porch of the cathedral. Abelard was normally one to shed his capa nigra promptly, hang the choir robe on its hook, and be off. But this evening he lingered. A line of clerics waited for a word with Fulbert, their shaved heads shining in light reflected from the flaming wall sconces. Stout and perspiring, Fulbert openly delighted in this communal show of deference. He dispensed small servings of his attention like communion wafers. At his elbow, waiting to receive his ceremonial berretum and cope, was his chaplain. But in the dark corner beyond the vestment case was the hunched form of Brother Thrall. Fulbert's waif-like servus was standing by with the canon's cloak and staff, ready to be gestured forward. Filius, nullius, son of no one. It shamed Peter suddenly to realize that he had hardly ever registered Canon Fulbert's omnipresent thrall, or the others like him scurrying about in the shadows of the cathedral and its close, like the rats they were set to catch. How many of these church slaves were there, Peter wondered. And, apart from Fulbert's lackey, whom Peter vaguely recognized, how were they distinguished one from another? Dark phantoms crossed his mind, figures glimpsed throughout Our Lady's precinct, but always on the edge of things, shoveling filth, hauling water, stacking firewood, or, if one of them was favored as the personal thrall of someone like Fulbert, holding ready the stave with which his lordship might then stride off or, on a whim, turn and beat him. Peter felt a bolt of vomit rising in his throat, a rancid distillation of loathing at his own blind indifference to these sorry bastards until now, when it was possible that he himself had spawned a next one. He thought of his dear Eloise, the certainty with which she dreaded the birth of a son, an incipient thrall. And for the first time, Peter Abelard felt the fear as she felt it, the sure knowledge that their child would be stolen from them and stunted for life. At last, Canon Fulbert turned to him. "Master Peter Abelard," he said, but icily, "how good of you to grace our vespers with your presence." Peter bowed, even while pushing down on the apprehension he felt at the canon's undisguised pique. "Your lordship, peace be with you." "And with you. What news from the infidel?"
"I beg your pardon, canon."
"The bishop received an account of your absence from Paris. He is not pleased."
"I am surprised His Excellency takes note of my whereabouts."
"What account?"
Peter's calm was counterfeit. This was not what he expected.
"Al Andalus, you traveled across the southern mountains, and not as a pilgrim on the way of St. James."
Peter snorted.
"A journey to and from Compostela, dear canon, requires many weeks." "The Jewish Academy at Mainz, then. The bishop knows you were away consulting Jews, again."
Peter Abelard shook his head.
He reined in his disdain, but he was wary. "As you know, canon, the Jewish Academy at Mainz was destroyed by the rabble armies of Peter the Hermit, a destruction which the Pope himself condemned.
Would that the Torah was still being studied along the Rhine.
I was not there. The bishop is misinformed.
You are the one who brings the pagan texts to Paris. You receive them from the Jews.
The pagan texts, Canon Fulbert? Cicero, Virgil, Plato, whom Justin Martyr called the unknowing Christian?
The loss of such texts to the Vandals was a catastrophe. Their recovery is a gift of wisdom, which of course is a name of God, Chokmat Elohim.
Fulbert tossed his head, shaking off the better knower's jab. He said, "The Proverbs tell us wisdom's instruction is to fear the Lord."
"Indeed so," Abelard replied. "And also, the Lord giveth wisdom, out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding."
"But God's enemies trade in these pagan books, the Saracens and Jews."
Canon Fulbert was a formidable man, but he could also be dull-witted. Abelard knew that if he was being patient, it was important not to be seen as being patient. He said,
"You make a point, Canon, a serious one. Nevertheless, it remains that Saracens and Jews advance God's purposes in this one realm. The books they translate define the study of universals and particulars, not only in our school, but in Orléans, Chartres, Reims, Metz, and Cologne. Yet Paris is supreme. The library of philosophers over which you preside is unsurpassed in Christendom. Does the bishop know of this preeminence? Surely you have helped him to take pride in your school?"
Fulbert knew that the exchange had gone against him, but he had no idea what to do about it. Peter Abelard rescued him by saying simply, "As for my absence, I went away to visit my family in Bretagne."
Fulbert said nothing, standing immobile. His chaplain crooked a finger at Brother Thrall, who came forward with the cloak. The chaplain took it and draped the canon's shoulders. Then the staff was handed over. Fulbert closed his fat fingers around it. Bowing, Peter Abelard said, "Canon Fulbert, I heartily wish to remain in your good graces. I am honored to be of your household."
Fulbert replied, "You have critics, Master Peter Abelard. The bishop hears from them. I hear from the bishop. No one hears from the legion of buffoonish boys who sit at your feet."
"Ah, but Canon, that the boys are legion is the point. Their numbers define the triumph of our school. They are not buffoons. In their generation, the gospel will be renewed throughout the world by the Holy Spirit making use of the learning they acquire here. The Holy Spirit is the wind that blows where it will, and our scholars have sailed upon it from all across Europe to the sacred college of thought you have created at Notre Dame de Paris. My critics, as you know, are the disappointed masters of the failing schools from which our lads have flown. Shall I meet with the bishop to explain all this to him?"
"No."
With a flip of his cloak, Fulbert made as if to go, but then stopped himself.
"My household, you said. You are present to it for the sake of my niece, Eloise."
"Indeed so, Canon, a brilliant young woman."
"Does her brilliance shine better at night?"
Fulbert's gaze hardened. The question threw Peter. Without imagining ahead of time how it could go, he had hoped in this encounter to test Fulbert's readiness to hear him out. When in doubt, Peter had often advised others, proceed with the truth. It was advice he had given himself, against himself, for days now. somehow, to lay the impossible truth of his love for Eloise before Fulbert. But Fulbert was not to be predicted, or rather, Fulbert was to be predicted in nothing but in his being dangerous. Peter had come here like a blind man, rubbing his hands across the rough surface of a wall, looking for an opening. But now the wall had closed around him, a jail cell. What did Fulbert know of their secret life at night? Peter recognized the canon's question as a trap, but also as a signal that his suspicions, if he had them, were not confirmed. All Peter knew for certain was that he would not lie. He said, "We have it from the book of Job. Some deep knowledge comes only in visions of the night. It is true. Your niece and I have occasionally pursued our work beyond the coming of dusk. It is true also that I have never before engaged with such a one as this noble young woman. I look forward to informing you more fully, Reverend Canon, of our progress. I would like to say now that I..." Peter paused, the wall again a blind search for an opening. "Have become mightily devoted to Eloise." Fulbert, having eyed Abelard carefully, looked sharply away, an evident act of deflection. "Yes, well," he said. The canon made a dismissive gesture with his free hand, and there was relief in it. "No matter now. Her lessons are suspended, concluded, in fact. In your absence, my niece decamped for the court of the Duke of Bourgogne, who, you remember, is her dearly departed mother's cousin. It is not certain that Eloise will return to Paris from Dijon. She is preparing there to become a lady-in-waiting to the mother of the queen consort. Eloise is a credit to us. Who knows? Perhaps the queen herself will tap her. Imagine our Eloise, a member of the royal court. In that case," with a wide grin, despite his resolve to be discreet, Fulbert betrayed his extreme delight. "She will return to Paris, but for the royal palace. I have advised the bishop of this. He is awaiting an opportunity to recommend her to the royal court, and he will tell King Louis of our role in her preparation." Fulbert touched Peter's arm almost fondly. "That would serve us both." He moved off before Peter could think what to say. In Canon Fulbert's vacant afterspace, Brother Thrall waited for Peter to look at him, and when he did, Peter flinched at the hatred he saw in the twisted creature's eyes. Once more, Peter thought of Eloise and their doomed son.
Chapter 12. Immediately after the six, Cavanaugh took the parish car without asking. He drove downtown, arriving at the Villard houses on Madison not long after 7:30, when the chancery offices and hallways would still be vacant. Just visible inside the elaborate double doors, the night watchman was still at his post in the great foyer, dwarfed by the gleaming chandelier that hung above him. He was a blue-suited, overweight retiree and ex-cop by Kavanaugh's guess. With his shiny, bald head forward, he was slumped in a purposely uncomfortable bentwood chair next to a small square table holding his chrome thermos and workman's lunchbox. Kavanaugh tapped softly on the door pane. The man snapped awake. He leapt to his feet. By crossing so quickly to the door, he displayed embarrassment at having been caught dozing, which Kavanaugh knew could work for him. The guard threw the lock and pulled the door open. "Sorry, father," he said. Here, beyond all places, the Roman collar was a pass. "No, Sarge, I'm the one who's sorry. It's too early by a mile.
I hate to disturb you. The guard pulled out a pocket watch, plainly relieved to read the time, more than 20 minutes to go before the building was to open. I left something upstairs yesterday, Kavanaugh said. I have to get it. Sure, Father, sure. It hit Kavanaugh how readily the lie had come. He said, I don't need to bother you. Just let me borrow the master key, would you? I'll just be a minute. The guard hesitated. A dozen or more priests manned offices here, and most of them, coming in late and leaving early, rarely crossed paths with a fellow on the night shift. But why wouldn't a chancery official have his own key? Kavanaugh said, I've just come from Mass. I have to get to the hospital. All true. I'll just be a minute, he repeated. The guard handed over the large ring with its set of 4 keys. It's this one, Father, the big one. Thanks, Sarge. The guard smiled. I never made it off the beat, Father. You've promoted me. You deserve it, Sarge. Kavanaugh saluted the man, then crossed into the regal main hall, his heels clicking on the high-polished marble. He made for the glittering grand staircase, the spine of the Renaissance Palazzo. At its foot, he looked back and saw that the guard was unscrewing his thermos. Good. Kavanaugh took the first several steps with a hop and successive treads, 2 at a time. On the second floor, he was struck again by the life-sized portraits on the gilded wall to his left, saints and prelates, the gallery of God, jogues, rogues. Episcopal Vicar for Clergy, he read at Bishop Donovan's door. In short order, Kavanaugh applied the key, threw the lock, and entered the outer office. The portrait of the risen Christ now struck him as another watchman, and he avoided the Lord's gaze to go directly to the file cabinet. The top drawer was marked, as he'd unconsciously noticed, Current Correspondence, and he opened it. He found a rack of folders, the tabs of which were marked with numbers, dates, he realized. He quickly calculated, 1 folder for each week. He withdrew the first 3 and positioned them on the clear surface of the cabinet. He opened first one, then the second, and the third, arranging stacks. He fingered through odds and ends of letters and note cards, unsure what exactly he was looking for. John Malloy. Runner. No. John Malloy. A school. New Jersey. That kind of school, agent had said. Therefore, quality paper, proper stationery. Through each stack, Kavanaugh found no Malloy. Complaints from pastors about curates, requests for transfer, condolence letters, recommendations, nothing from John Malloy. His pulse had quickened, and now he felt the muscles in his chest tighten. His heart rushed. The crushing headache of the day before was gone, but he was alert for its return. Once he'd visualized the file cabinet and the drawer label, once he'd recalled Bishop Donovan's reference to the letter, special delivery out of the blue, he'd imagined a way forward. But this was a dead end. Out of the blue. The letter, he realized all at once, would have been addressed not to an official, the vicar for clergy, but to a long-lost friend, personal, therefore not the bureaucracy file cabinet, but somewhere else, Donovan's desk. Kavanaugh gathered the letters and cards back into their folders, the folders back into their drawer. Now, though, there was a tremor in his hands. What was he doing? What was he thinking? A letter kept apart out of the secretary's purview? What would that imply? He went to the bishop's door, ready to try the master key again, but the door was unlocked. He entered, crossed, and quickly found himself at the window alcove, inside the U-shaped desk. He was moving fast. If he stopped to think, he would simply stop. Instead, he efficiently set about opening drawers, first the center one, then the column of 3 on the right, in one of which, lying prone, was a pint of Jim Beam and a shot glass. Under the pint was a manila envelope with the letters R.I.P. scrawled across it. The left topmost drawer was cluttered with pencils, a pair of scissors, a box of clips, a blotter, a ball of rubber bands, erasers, a bottle of Carter's ink, all of which, as if set to do so, pressed down on a single, business-sized envelope. He picked it up, like an item of contraband. Addressed in clear handwriting to Bishop Sean Donovan, the Chancery, Archdiocese of New York, Madison Avenue, New York. The envelope, aside from the special delivery stamp angled across the lower left corner, was otherwise blank. No return address. The letter had been slit open, and Kavanaugh withdrew its page, a formal longhand note beginning, "Dear Bishop Donovan," and signed, "Sincerely yours, John Molloy." No address. The letter declared in three sentences Molloy's intention to come to Bishop Donovan's office for a brief visit at 4 p.m. on Monday, November 13th, 3 days ago, the afternoon before Runner turned up at the communion rail at Good Shepherd. The brevity of the note, its formality, the lack of any explanation or way to return contact, added up to the writer's wily caution. What was up with John Molloy? Not a hint. As had happened the other morning, such self-protection stymied Michael Kavanaugh. But he thought of Rachel Vedette. "There is a way to learn what you need to learn. You must find it." That was all. He refolded the letter. As he returned it to its envelope, he looked at the written address again. Was it only the passage of time that made the penmanship unfamiliar? Yet the looped cursive, with a flourish of taglines at the ends of words, conveyed a bright self-assurance that Kavanaugh had associated with his old friend, and he felt the pang of having missed him all these years, and now, at this dead end, of missing him again. But then, he saw the postmark, with its flutter of lines, canceling the stamp in the upper right-hand corner. The smudged black ink showed the date inside the circle of words. Lake Durham, Sparta Township, N.J. He stared for a moment. He put the envelope back in the drawer, replaced the desk paraphernalia as it had been, closed the drawer, and quickly left the bishop's office. Clipping down the palazzo stairs, he glanced ahead and saw, just entering the grand hall, the schoolmarmish woman from the day before, Bishop Donovan's secretary, caught. Kavanaugh slowed his pace so that their paths crossed at the foot of the stairs instead of closer to the night guard. He touched his forehead nonchalantly. "Morning, ma'am." She was startled, of course, and might have spoken, a query at least, perhaps a challenge. But he kept going. At the door, still moving, he dropped the key ring on the square table beside the lunchbox. "Thanks, Sarge," he said, and tossed another salute. "Catch up on your sleep now." The parking garage at the Waldorf Astoria, two blocks away, welcomed the cathedral clergy gratis, and that was where he had parked. He returned to the car, then had another thought. He grabbed his books and went into the hotel. From a phone booth in the lobby, he called Good Shepherd and asked Frank Russell to cover for him at the hospital. He thought of asking for the Monsignor to request permission for the use of the car, but instead told Frank to let the boss know he had it. What the hell? He had to kill some time. He went to the corner coffee shop, took a table, and, leaving his breviary aside, opened the leather-bound book, picking a page at random. Translation, in truth, did not come easily to him. The gossip at last reached Fulbert's ears. It was with great difficulty he gave credit to what he heard, for he loved his niece and was prejudiced in my favor. Kavanaugh looked up, afraid all at once of appearing foolish. As had been true all those years before in theology class, he marked the work of puzzling through Latin by moving his lips as he read, and he realized he'd been doing that now. He looked around. The shop was a bustle with businessmen and tourists. No one cared a damn for a solitary priest with his little book of Latin.